of the occupied territories, both those who are still there and those who have been displaced. This would include Muslims, Christians, and Jews and their descendants, all original Palestinians. Iran even presented its initiative entitled National Referendum in Palestine to the United Nations. Today, Jerusalem, as Trump's preferred capital of Israel, is not the only sore spot with the people of the region and Muslim world. The United States recognized the Golan Heights as part of Israel through a presidential proclamation signed by Donald Trump on March the 25th, 2019. This made the United States the first country to recognize Israeli rather than Syrian sovereignty over the Golan Heights region.
Trump took a very hurried approach and tried to do a wide range of things in a short time. Israel has been pursuing the policy of expelling the Palestinians and latching onto power for the past 7 years, but has tried to adapt its approaches to what has been needed over the course of time. This has been ongoing until today, when they have proposed a two-state solution so they can lay the groundwork for achieving their goals. But Trump proposed the issue of the West Bank, the occupied Golan Heights, the deal of the century, and the relocation of the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds simultaneously in a very short span of time.
Soon after, in 2020, came the notorious bound-to-fail deal of the century, what Iran calls treason of the century. This Trump or Kushner plan was officially titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. It claimed to be the road to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or rather, Israel-imposed conflict with Palestine. Practically, the plan would have bought out the Palestinians for measly comforts, nothing close to even a realistic two-state solution. Comforts for their country. It was on 22nd June 2019 that the Trump administration released the economic portion of the plan titled Peace to Prosperity. The political portion was released in late January 2020.
They did not succeed in the deal of the century, and in the case of the occupied Golan Heights and the West Bank, they only incited the anger of Jordan, Egypt, and Syria. More importantly, when Donald Trump adopted the policy, he thought he could have the support of many Arab nations. He believed with a strong Arab support, he could back Israel. They believed that instead of negotiating with 1% of Arabs, who are Palestinians, they had to clinch agreements with the 99% so they support Israel. Although some heads of state did so, opinion polls show the issue has only aroused the disgust and the opposition of Arab nations against the United States.
It's no wonder even whatever Palestinians might have been considering a two-state solution boycotted Trump's peace plan and hence had him scrap U.S. funding for Palestinians to pressure them into allowing Israel's expansionism. Expansionism used in relation to Israel highlights the fact that Israel is a modern-day invading power and has no business taking from or sharing with Palestinians. And any West Asian accepting the notion of Israel or a dual Israel-Palestine state is doing so just to take what he can, or out of sympathy with fourth-generation now Israelis. Eyes are now turned to current U.S. President Biden and his role in the peace process or no process. How much he can do is to be seen. Israeli right-wing parties, which dominate the political arena, reject the two-state solution and call for the annexation of about a third of the West Bank. And the Jerusalem Post newspaper listed a rundown of 11 senior Jewish American officials designated for top roles in the Biden administration. The one low casualty way would be if Joe Biden realized the importance of keeping the UN alive by rising above America's misuse of its vetoing power, largely speaking. The number of UN resolutions condemning Israel are more than the total number of UN resolutions against the rest of the world. By 2020, 43 of 46 anti-Israel UN Security Council resolutions were vetoed by the US. And so, instead of Israel stopping in its tracks, it charges on with its agenda, knowing it has undivided backing from the US.
As history has shown, and as we have seen in the last 7 years, the American politicians have a common policy on the issue of Palestine and support for the Israel regime, and that there is no difference between Democrats and Republicans except for the methods they adopt. They appear to have tactical differences but have the same goal in practice, which is supporting Israel.
What measures has been taken by the previous American administration head by Donald Trump, which has been surrendered or changed by the existing Biden administration? Nothing. They did not return the embassy to Tel Aviv. They did not surrender to the announcement of Jerusalem as an eternal united capital of Israel. They did not do anything about the settlement expansions and the settlement issues inside West Bank and Jerusalem. They did not lift the embargo and sanction over Gaza. They did not do anything.
Even justifying the occupation of Palestine and bearing it down memory lane by prolonging the process cannot whitewash what's going on under Israeli occupation. Even with corona rampaging, there's no respite for Palestinian kids behind bars with no charge. No less than 4,500 Palestinians are in Israeli jails. Of the thousands behind bars, 430 are administrative detainees held without charge or trial, including 180 children and 41 women and girls. There are 550 prisoners suffering from various illnesses, including 11 with cancer, 7 with kidney failure, and heart disease.
The irony, or maybe the racist issue, I would say, in that Israelis are claiming that they are giving the vaccine to the Palestinian, but on the other hand, they are giving the vaccine to those Palestinians who are working in the occupied area where they are having an interaction with Israeli citizens. This is why Israel is giving the propaganda that they are, and the beautiful face, that they are giving vaccines to the Palestinian. No, they are not giving the vaccine to every Palestinian. In the same area like in Al-Quds, why they are allowing the vaccine to the Israelis and they are not allowing the vaccines to the Palestinian? Where they claim their own custody, they claim their own government over Al-Quds, over Jerusalem. Why they are doing this discrimination?
But like I said, Israel could be overdoing it with the expansion and inhumane pain it's inflicting on Palestinians, as well as needling other countries such as Iran. And this may backfire on it, especially as the predominantly Muslim region is more determined than before, with greater military might and know-how.
Today we see that Palestine and the resistance are stronger than ever. And we also see Israel, whose slogan used to be dominance from the Nile to the Euphrates, is now trapped within its own fence, unable to govern itself. We are witnessing the events in occupied Palestine. It has reached a point where Israelis and the Jewish residing in Palestine are getting fed up with the status quo. Despite all the concerns and all the betrayals committed by some Muslim nations, the Palestinian resistance is still strong.
That's it for today, but the Palestinian cause lives on to be voiced and fought for. We will be covering developments as we do all sorts of topics, so do tune in at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The first-time defenders of Donald J. Trump came for Representative Liz Cheney for the offense of having voted to impeach him. Fellow Republicans closed ranks to save her leadership post, with Representative Kevin McCarthy boasting that the Big Tent Party had enough room for both the former president and for a stalwart critic. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Nicholas Pandos and Katie Edmondson. The piece is titled, "House Republicans Have Had Enough of Liz Cheney's Truth-Telling." First-time defenders of Donald Trump came for Representative Liz Cheney for the offense of having voted to impeach him. Fellow Republicans closed ranks to save her leadership post, with Representative Kevin McCarthy boasting that the Big Tent Party had enough room for both the former president and for a stalwart critic. But evidently, no more. Just 3 months after she beat back a no-confidence vote by lopsided margins, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the number three House Republican, is facing a far more potent challenge that appears increasingly likely to end in her ouster from leadership. This time, Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, is encouraging the effort to replace her. Her transgression, colleagues say, Liz Cheney's continued public criticism of Donald Trump, her denunciation of his lies about a stolen election, and her demands that the GOP tell the truth about how his supporters assaulted democracy during the 6th of January riot at the Capitol. The turnabout reflects anew the passion with which Republicans have embraced Donald Trump and the voters who revere him, and how willing many in the Republican Party are to perpetuate, or at least to tolerate, falsehoods about the 2020 election that Donald Trump has continued to spread. The latest test for Liz Cheney could come as soon as next week, when a growing group of Republicans is planning a fresh bid to dethrone her, with Kevin McCarthy's blessing. Many of her colleagues are now so confident that it will succeed that they are openly discussing who would replace Liz Cheney. The tensions escalated on Tuesday, 4th of May, when Kevin McCarthy went on Donald Trump's favorite news program, Fox and Friends, to question whether Liz Cheney could effectively carry out her role as the party's top messenger. Beforehand, McCarthy had told a Fox Channel reporter, he had said, "I've had it with her and I've lost confidence," according to a leaked recording of the exchange published by the website Axios. "I have heard from members concerned about her ability to carry out the job as conference chair, to carry out the message," Kevin McCarthy said during the portion of the interview that aired. "We all need to be working as one if we're able to win the majority." With one-time allies closing in, Liz Cheney, known for her steely temperament, has only dug in harder. Minutes after Kevin McCarthy's television hit, she sent her barbed reply through a spokesman, effectively suggesting that the minority leader and Republicans moving against her were complicit in Donald Trump's dissembling. "This is about whether the Republican Party is going to perpetuate lies about the 2020 presidential election, an attempt to whitewash what happened on 6th of January," said Jeremy Adler, the spokesman. Liz Cheney will not do that. That is the issue. One of the few Republican voices willing to rise for Liz Cheney's defense was Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, who has himself come under attack from his party for his unrepentant criticism of Donald Trump, even getting booed at the Utah Republican Party convention on Saturday, 1st of May. "Every person of conscience draws a line beyond which they will not go. Liz Cheney refuses to lie. Mitt Romney wrote on Twitter, "As one of my Republican Senate colleagues said to me following my impeachment vote, I wouldn't want to be a member of a group that punished someone for following their conscience." Many House Republicans insist they have no problem with Liz Cheney's vote to impeach Donald Trump, which she described as a vote of conscience. Nor, they say, are they bothered by her neoconservative policy positions, which skew, like those of her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney, toward a hawkishness that is at odds with the America First slant of the party that Donald Trump cemented. But they fear that Liz Cheney's refusal to stop criticizing Donald Trump or condemning the events of 6th of January could weaken the party's message going into the 2022 midterm elections, when they hope to portray Democrats as big government socialists so villainous they should be voted out of the majority. It has also infuriated the former President Donald Trump. Many, including Kevin McCarthy, had hoped that after surviving the February vote of no confidence, Liz Cheney, as an elected leader, would make like the rest of the party and simply move on. Instead, she has doubled down and at times turned her fire on colleagues. The final straw for many came last week in Orlando, Florida, where Republicans gathered for their annual policy retreat in hopes of putting on a show of unity. Liz Cheney told Punchbowl News that she would campaign in Wyoming, where she faces a primary challenge defending her impeachment vote every day of the week. She told reporters that any lawmaker who led the bid to invalidate President Biden's electoral victory in Congress should be disqualified from running for president. And she broke with leading Republicans when she said a proposed independent commission to investigate the 6th of January riot should focus on the attack on the Capitol building by a pro-Trump mob, rather than scrutinizing violence by Antifa and Black Lives Matter movement, as Kevin McCarthy and other Republicans have demanded. Just a few days later, she drew attacks from the right for fist-bumping Joe Biden at his speech before a joint session of Congress, and took to Twitter to defend herself for greeting the president in a civil, respectful, and dignified way. "We're not sworn enemies," she wrote, "we're Americans." On Monday, and after Donald Trump issued a statement calling the 2020 election fraudulent and the big lie, Liz Cheney quickly tweeted her rebuttal, writing that anyone who made such claims was poisoning our democratic system. Some Republicans privately likened her performance to picking at a scab, and many of Mr. Trump's allies saw it as an opening to try to depose her. "Liz has attempted and is failing badly to divide our party," Representative Lance Gooden, a Republican from Texas, wrote on Twitter on Tuesday, emulating Donald Trump's caustic Twitter style. "Trump is still the leader of the GOP, Liz. I look forward to her being removed soon." Liz Cheney's troubles chart a rapid shift for the Republican Party in the few months since Donald Trump left Washington. Early on, she was part of a small but influential group of Republicans that included Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader, and condemned Donald Trump's role in stoking the riot with false claims of a stolen election. But many of those lawmakers have since gone quiet, leaving Liz Cheney, who once was enthusiastically spoken of as a future speaker or future president, she's now very isolated within the Republican Party. Liz Cheney declined through a spokesman to comment, and several of her allies in the House would not speak on the record in her defense, underscoring the fraught nature of the vote and the pessimism some of them feel about her chances of surviving another challenge. A spokeswoman for Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, another Republican who voted to impeach Donald Trump and has been a leading critic of the former president, said in a statement that the congressman unequivocally supports Liz Cheney for conference chair. Those who know her best say privately that Liz Cheney's predicament reflects both her principles and her personality, including a stubborn streak that sometimes prompts her to act against her own self-interest. One ally who has been exasperated by her in recent months described her actions as classic Liz Cheney. She will always do what she thinks is right, the Republican said on Tuesday, but she will just never stop to think that she's wrong.
Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has expressed concern over the violence that Bahraini security forces have inflicted on prisoners at the Job Prison in Manama. This after prisoners initiated a peaceful sit-in complaining about their treatment and the neglect of another political prisoner, which led to his death. After more than a decade of protests by the Bahraini people, the regime continues with its brutal attack against the people of this country, both inside of prisons and out.
Protests are growing in Bahrain, inside and outside prison walls, so is the regime crackdown. On Friday, the UN Human Rights Office described as disturbing the Bahraini regime's use of force to break up a peaceful sit-in at the country's main prison mid-April. OICHR slammed as unnecessary and disproportionate the violent repression of the sit-in at Jao Prison, located south of the capital, Manama. The inmates have been demonstrating against detention conditions, particularly the lack of access to medical treatment. The sit-in started in early April after the death of a political prisoner due to reportedly being denied timely access to essential health care. Outside the prison, Bahrainis have been holding similar protests calling for the release of political prisoners and better conditions. OICHR says the lack of health care in overcrowded Bahraini prisons has been an issue for years, which has turned into a chronic problem due to the coronavirus pandemic. It says Manama's response to protests has been in the form of more detentions. Thousands of opposition politicians, activists, journalists, and human rights defenders have been imprisoned in Western allied Bahrain since an uprising in 2011 and subsequent years of crackdown.
The Bahraini regime has been clamping down very viciously on these political prisoners that have been protesting against appalling conditions in Bahraini prisons. These are, in fact, political prisoners. It's important to emphasize, because these are people that had protested very peacefully back in 2011, demanding political reforms, democratic rights, and human rights, and even citizenship rights. They've been protesting not only against the appalling conditions that exist there, but these conditions have been worsened as a consequence of the pandemic.
Bahrain's most prominent cleric, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ghassem, says drawing up a new constitution is the only way out of the political crisis. He has urged the regime to pursue an agreement with the opposition instead of increasingly suppressing the dissidents. That advice is likely to fall on deaf ears, given over 10 years of crackdown. However, with every protest chipping away at the legitimacy and authority of the Al-Khalifa regime, it is only fast-tracking the inevitable, which cannot be suppressed.
I'd like to welcome my first guest out of Washington, D.C., author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman. Michael, great to have you with us. Now, Michael, we look at the situation in Bahrain. I mean, what is it about the regime? Why is the regime so repressive against the people there? What is it trying to get to?
was trying desperately to hold on to power, and it's been backed by Saudi Arabia and the United States since the beginning of the protest 10 years ago, with the Saudis invading the country to help crack down on people who wanted a better way of life and a little bit of democracy. And, of course, the United States supports it militarily and financially, using it as the base for the Fifth Fleet that sails the Persian Gulf instead of the American Gulf. And there are some 20,000 soldiers, sailors, and Marines there. And the Americans love this, and it puts money in the coffers. It's propped up the Al Khalifa dynasty. So if this were taken away, the country would collapse, if you can call it a country. It's basically a city with some dirt around it. And there wouldn't be any more Khalifas. There wouldn't be any more overcrowded prisons. There wouldn't be any more beatings. There wouldn't be any more killings. But unfortunately, nobody will do anything about it. It's like the weather. You always talk about it, but you don't do anything about it.
And let's look at the other side of the coin, Michael, because on the one hand, we have the regime, which is behaving so oppressively. On the other hand, we have, as far as those countries, that they're giving this regime full support, we're talking about, especially these Western countries like the United States or like the UK. What's in it for them? Why are they supporting this repressive regime?
Well, one, of course, it's value for money. They sell weapons and other sorts of arms and ammunition and things to the Khalifas to control their country. And also, it's used as a base against Iran. It's one of the many bases that the Americans have built encircling the country. And they see the Fifth Fleet sailing up and down the Persian Gulf as a way of controlling Iran and keeping Iran from exercising even a modicum amount of control in the region there, in the water. They scream bloody murder every time a couple of motorboats sail within a couple of hundred meters of an American warship. So it's, again, it's money for the merchants of death, and it's control, political control, and economic control aimed at Iran.
Well, welcome my next guest out of London from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, Reza, why do we not see more forceful language being used by this UN office? Now, it said it is disturbed by what has happened in the prison in Manama, but it doesn't seem to hold it responsible or demand any type of action. Your take on that?
I think one of the things that we need to recognize that the United Nations is going to be is often limited by the powers like Britain, like America, who have particular influences that they bring to bear on Bahrain and what they want to do. And so when that kind of control is there, it makes it very difficult for the United Nations officials to be able to say the things that really should be said. It's quite clear what has gone on. It is unacceptable. It is clearly problematic and so on. So there are some serious issues in terms of that that need to be addressed. But this is a historical problem. This is something that has been going on in Bahrain for a number of years, where Britain would actually try to be the champion of democracy and lecture people around the world, when in fact it's ex-British police officers and MI6 agents and so on have been involved and managing the torture of people in Bahrain, anyone who rises up or says something against the government. And this is something that goes back decades in terms of how Britain has actually been playing a very dirty role on the ground, and people from official places like the MI6 or like the police and so on, or ex-police officers and so on, are directly involved in managing how this is actually controlled and what actually happens on the ground in terms of the regime and legitimizing the regime and the managing when things of this ilk actually happen. So this is going back in terms of the stuff that happens quite some time. So it's not surprising in a sense.
Well, Michael, the majority of these prisoners are political prisoners, meaning they're activists, they're former politicians, they're academics, etc. And we don't see or hear a whole lot. I mean, they're being basically incarcerated due to their beliefs. But, I mean, when we look at a situation, for example, we have a situation right now in Russia where an individual, the West is calling him a political prisoner, or it can be other places like Venezuela or Iran, and we see what they do when they talk about political prisoners. But we have these individuals and so many of them that are in Bahraini jails, but nothing is being done. Why?
Well, first off, as you mentioned, the people that are being targeted by the United States and the European Union, such as President Putin of Russia and Maduro in Venezuela and the Castros in Cuba, they want the American government wants these people overthrown. They want the legitimate government of Iran overthrown and replaced by governments friendly to the West, governments that will do the bidding of the apartheid entity that styles itself Israel. But God forbid that anyone should question the so-called allies of the United States, the organizations and countries that facilitate the operation of the American imperium around the world. Bahrain is one great example of this. Without Manama as the home port of the American Fifth Fleet, the Americans would have a substantial loss of control in the region. So they pick and they choose. They support human rights when they want to overthrow a government or gain political influence. They turn a blind eye to places like Iran and Saudi Arabia and the apartheid entity when they engage in murder, war crimes, and human rights violations because it's in their interest. They have friends, they have people that will give them influence, that will do translations and dirty work and things like this. And therefore, the Americans love that.
Well, Reza, we have witnessed protests on and off now for over a decade in Bahrain. Do you think that there has been any progress regarding human rights in that country, or has the situation deteriorated?
I think over that period of time, it would be fair to say that things have actually deteriorated quite considerably. And I think what is further telling within all of this, that while there was some kind of lip service that was being paid initially to what was going on, being unacceptable, gradually over a period of time, this has actually changed, and there is indifference towards political indifference, no political will, and no kind of desire to hide their indifference.
Why is that? Let me just jump in here, Reza. You said no desire to even hide their indifference. So what does that mean? Does that mean there is absolutely no accountability, not obviously inside the country and not from international entities? Your take.
Yeah, so within the country, it's it's even things like where you've got medical concerns of individual prisoners, and we've seen that whether it's cancer cases, whether it's the corona or issues to do with that, whether it's looking after people who have got medical conditions, all of that has been used as a weapon. So it's been weaponized to deliberately ignore those symptoms, those problems, and those issues to make sure that those people's conditions actually worsen. So it's a systematic problem. It's a systemic problem. So at any level of humanity, in terms of basic humanity and human rights or humanitarian kind of issues that are raised by these things, you would have expected that there would have been an outcry regarding making sure that those people got the treatment, were treated, and had their legitimate medical needs and so on met. But there's been a systemic and systematic abuse of that within, and no kind of calling out of this on the international level by either the British government or the American government. And to not even do that is clearly a signal of what's they don't care, and they're not worried about the fact that they are seen to not care. And I think it's those kind of things that suggest that there is very little accountability by them of the Bahraini regime and what it's doing, and also their minions in terms of British police officers that are on the ground in Bahrain managing some of these things in terms of what's actually going on, managing the publicity around this and so on and so forth. So all of these things are very much intertwined, and I think that lack of accountability on the international level is also a problem and needs to be recognized mm-hmm. and called out for what it is. I mean, they don't care, and they don't care that they are shown to not care either. And I think the solutions to the problems in Bahrain will need to be coming from elsewhere, because if you're looking for the West to provide those solutions, it's not going to happen. They need to be coming. New thought needs to be given to that.
Okay. Well, Michael, originally protests call for political reforms through peaceful demonstrations, but the regime could not even tolerate that. So what do you make of this? And so what are the options? I mean, Reza just said that there has to be some new thought about basically help is not coming from the outside. So what needs to happen in your perspective?
Well, what needs to happen is that the United Nations has got to stop talking and wringing its hands about how things are bad there. The United States State Department's report on human rights on Bahrain for last year goes through a litany of its crimes against the people and its repression to the point where in prison you're not safe because you're beaten, you have poor medical care, and so forth. I think that short of an armed invasion of Bahrain, as the United Nations sanctioned in Korea in the early 1950s, and then in the 90s in Yugoslavia and in Iraq, nothing's going to be done. You've got to point out exactly what's happening. You've got to get the international news media to break their ties with government and point out exactly what is being done to the people of Bahrain by the American-supported government, by the British-supported government, and we've got to really point the finger and publicize this. Certainly publicizing what went on in South Africa brought an end to apartheid, and if you could get the news media to do the same thing in Israel or the same thing with Bahrain, it might be another story, but that's a big task, and you've got to persuade these corporate giants that it's in their interest to report the news factually and carefully and accurately.
Well, Reza, Sheikh Isa Qasim, the main religious leader, of course, of Bahrain, says a new constitution is the only way to end the repression in that country. Your take on that, and what would it take for that to happen?
I think in terms of the new constitution and so on, I can't see the Bahraini authorities agreeing to that, because that would mean limiting the powers that the king would have, limiting the powers that would be had in order to continue the oppression that they are doing in terms of meeting the needs and the aspirations of the Bahraini people. So while this is a legitimate demand, and I think it's appropriate that something like this is instigated and done and provides an alternative about what the way forward could be, and it says very clearly to people looking into Bahrain internationally that, look, there are solutions on the ground that are legitimate, that are valid, and all of those things are there. I think it's very appropriate that something like that is happening. But at the same time, don't hold your breath that this is going to be something that's they're going to roll over and allow that to be done, and the new constitution to be brought in, because it will be, which oppressor would like their powers to be limited in any way? Which person, megalomaniac, is going to want to have their powers limited? And that's simply not going to happen. And
so you said that another thought process, sorry to interrupt you, I'm just so limited in time, but you said another thought process, Reza, has to be taken into consideration, because as I said earlier, repeating what you said, that the help is not going to come from those Western powers or the so-called international agency that's supposed to be dealing with human rights. So what's the answer in your perspective? What has to be done?
So I think it's a multitude of things that need to happen. I mean, if there are people sitting outside, I mean, it's looking at grassroots, it's looking at institutional links with Bahrain. So whether it's academic, whether it's on the sporting field, whether it's any of those kind of things that can, so whether it's Formula One that goes there, targeting those people and those kind of things to actually say, you need to rein back, you need to pull out, because this is, what you're doing is supporting a regime which is oppressive, and so on and so forth. So I think at one level, it's got to be that. At the grassroots level within Bahrain, we need to think about, it's like any oppressive system or any oppressive government. Are they going to roll over? They're not, unless you give them and make them an offer and provide them the resistance that is required to make them realize that an alternative offer is actually worthwhile in terms of taking, and think about how that resistance needs to be manifested. So that there is one level in terms of demonstrations, in terms of all of these things that are going to be taking place on the ground, and they have been happening for years and decades in some senses, in terms of what's been going on. Obviously with the whole 2011 and where it started, there was an intensity that was created after that period of time that it was going on for. But I think obviously all of these things will continue, but I think another angle in terms of whether looking at resistance in a different kind of form might be an option that needs to be looked at. So I think that I would say that people need to look at those options, and when those options are on the table, the government will start to think, okay, is it really going to be worth my while to take on a resistance that is going to be much more assertive and aggressive in what they do?
Okay, and on that note, appreciate you being with us, both of you, actually. Author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C. Always a pleasure, Michael, and Islamic Human Rights Commission. Reza Kazem, out of London, thank you so much. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Cronyism and outsourcing have defined the British government's response to the pandemic. From the VIP lane for personal protective equipment, PPE suppliers, with connections to the Tory party, to the privatized track and trace system so flawed, it was described by Sage as only being of marginal impact. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Andrew Fisher Ryder. This article is published under the heading NHS is being privatized by stealth under cover of a pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Cronyism and outsourcing have defined the British government's response to the pandemic. From the VIP lane for personal protective equipment, PPE suppliers, with connections to the Tory party, to the privatized track and trace system so flawed, it was described by Sage as only being of marginal impact. But less attention has been paid to what the longer-term impact of these decisions might be. Far from being an aberration, the government's pandemic response reflects its commitment to embedding private interests at the heart of the state and stealthy chipping away at most valued national institution. As Sir David King, a former chief scientific advisor and the special representative for climate change under Boris Johnson when he was foreign secretary recently told The Guardian, the government is slipping through plans to effectively privatize the NHS by stealth in the name of a pandemic. This story of privatization is not one of the wholesale transfers, such as the sell-off of British Gas or Royal Mail, but rather of a gradual hollowing out, a process that has been further accelerated by the pandemic and will continue under the Johnson government. In 2010, for example, the NHS spent £4.1 billion on private sector contracts. By 2019, this had more than doubled to £9.2 billion. Already, the government's pandemic response is shaping the future structures of the NHS, public procurement and public scrutiny. Look at PPE procurement, which has functioned recently as a giant slush fund for Tory donors. The charity says these red flags require more, not less, scrutiny. But less scrutiny is precisely what the government has been engineering. Ministers are still refusing to publish the full list of companies that were placed in the VIP lane after being endorsed by politicians or senior civil servants. The Register of Ministers' Financial Interest, which should be published every 6 months, was last updated 9 months ago. Basic avenues of accountability and transparency are consistently being closed down or obstructed. Journalists have found freedom of information requests delayed or blocked by the clearinghouse unit set up in the Cabinet Office to screen requests, while leaked emails show the Cabinet Office is collating lists of journalists with details about their work and intervening when sensitive subjects are inquired about. Meanwhile, the role of overseeing the ministerial code was left vacant for 5 months after Sir Alex Allen resigned when Johnson opted not to sack Patel for breaching the code last November. His replacement, Christopher Gate, will still not be able to initiate investigations into improperty without the Prime Minister's approval. These instances reflect a dilution of oversight that bodes ill for the future. Scaling back scrutiny and accountability are vital ways of providing cover for further NHS privatization, a policy ministers know to be politically unpopular. Another way of doing this is through the creation of new bodies, spearheaded by figures who are compliant with the sensitive to do this government agenda. Hanok had sought to replace Public Health England PHE with the National Institute for Health Protection. The consulting firm McKinsey was paid £560,000 for 5 weeks' work drawing up plans for the new body. Dido Harding, who sits in the House of Lords as a Tory peer, was initially chosen to head the new body, an appointment that Lord Falconer termed a corruption of British Constitution. After backlash against the government's attempts to subsume Public Health Experts under Track and Trace Management, NIHP, will now become the UK Health Security Agency, UKHSA, headed by Dr. Jenny Harris. Understandably, the creation of UKHSA and abolition of PHE has upset dedicated public professionals across the health service. Another policy decision that may strengthen the cronyist approach adopted during the pandemic is the Health and Social Care White Paper, which was published in February this year and spun as a set of policies that would unravel Andrew Lancey's 2012 Health and Social Care Act. The white paper sets out how integrated care systems, ICS, will be rolled out, combining NHS Trust with GP services as commissioners from a single budget pot. These ICS bodies will no longer be required to put contracts out to tender, but can instead award them directly, creating opportunities for contracts to be awarded to politically connected firms. The campaigning think tank We Own It is concerned that these plans would embed the role of the private sector within the health service, but with less transparency and accountability over contracts. Indeed, GP services are an area where the private sector is taking an increasing interest, with U.S. health giants such as Centene Corporation buying up GP services through its UK arm, Operos Health. Campaigners are worried these ICS bodies will be unaccountable and profit-making, and that private providers could sit on their commissioning boards. It's not yet clear whether ICS board meetings will be public and subject to FOI requests. It's not just GP services that are an area of concern. In August last year, the government announced a four-year plan to spend £10 billion of taxpayers' money on private hospitals in order to clear NHS waiting list. This has been justified as an emergency measure to deal with a backlog. But the question remains why this money was used to fund private providers rather than NHS capacity. The health campaigner John Lister says the institutionalized use of private hospitals will likely leave the NHS weakened and could lead to long-term expansion of the private sector for elective care. This points to the core of the issue. Though ministers have sought to justify their decisions with reference to the exceptional circumstances of COVID-19, many of these decisions instead seem part of a longer-term plan to embed political appointees and private providers at the heart of the state. Rather than selling off the NHS outright, a decision politicians know would be unpopular. They are instead doing this through the back door, by stealth.